first case for argument this morning is Marcus and Millichap Real Estate against Sekulovsky. Mr. Goodman.
Good morning. May it please the court. As the court's aware, this is a dispute about real estate commissions and focused largely on 17 transactions. It's a dispute between a sales agent and a firm that he was formerly associated with, and the claims against Mr. Sekulovsky are predicated primarily on the Marcus and Millichap Reese policy manual, which is supposed to form the rules governing the commission split.
So before we get too far into this, I have a question about subject matter jurisdiction. What in the record establishes that your client was a citizen of Ohio when this suit was filed?
I believe, Your Honor, that Mr. Sekulovsky testified that he resided in the state of Ohio. He did have a...
That's not the question I asked. I asked what establishes that he was a citizen of Ohio. The question here is domicile. That means intent to remain. And your client's ties to Ohio seem slight.
Well, he lives in Ohio. He lived in Ohio when the lawsuit was filed. He has maintained domicile in Illinois and did during the time he worked for Marcus and Millichap maintain a residence, and his office was principally in Chicago. After he terminated his employment with Marcus and Millichap, he relocated to Arizona and then Ohio. Actually, always maintained a residence in Ohio.
Would you perhaps address my question, which is what in the record establishes that his domicile is in Ohio?
I am not certain, Your Honor, that he was technically domiciled in Ohio during the...
You see, counsel, that is the question for purposes of diversity jurisdiction. We need to know the man's domicile. This is not a case where it's quite apparent that his domicile is Ohio, and this lawsuit arises from his employment in Chicago. It looked from the record like after Chicago he set up shop in Arizona, but maybe that's mistaken. But the complaint alleges a citizenship in Ohio, and having no Illinois ties is essential to diversity, which is why I'm asking, what does the record show?
In terms of when he was sued, he did not live in Illinois. He did live, his testimony was he lived in Arizona and Ohio. He wasn't domiciled in Illinois during the time the lawsuit was filed against him. And during the pendency of the lawsuit, his domicile was not.
Well, maybe I will also need to ask this of your adversary. But so far, you haven't told me anything that's in the record. Now, maybe you think his testimony implies domicile.
In Ohio?
Yes. That's the question.
I understand the question. And I believe that I think that the point of where his actual domicile, whether it was in Ohio or Arizona, he always maintained, I believe, his primary, and it would be from his testimony, and I do believe it was always in Ohio, although he did split when he was working for Marcus and Millichap Chicago. He did have a residence here, and when he worked in Arizona, he did have a residence in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
So, assuming that there is diversity, the dispute would focus upon and would be based upon a policy manual that M&M Chicago said, the testimony was the constitution for the relationship between its sales agents and the company itself. The contract claims, the fraud claims, all arise from that or based upon the commission splits that are described and provided for within that policy manual. And again, there's an issue about whether or not that policy manual really was a contract between M&M Chicago and Mr. Sekulowski. But assuming that it was, even if we were to assume that it was, the commission splits provided for in the policy manual are simply either a default on a even split between agents if you had more than one agent representing a side, or as those agents directed the company. Again, it was basically a directive to the company as to how it was to issue checks, the commission payments, to the sales agents. It did not require any showing of what either or any of the sales agents contributed to the transaction. And in fact, that would be a difficult thing to do because, for example, how does one define the contribution brought by somebody who actually brings in the deal by virtue of relationships as opposed to the person who filled out the paperwork? One may spend a lot of time doing the documentation for the deal, but there is no deal if the transaction isn't brought in, if the relationship isn't brought in. So the relationships would be key. So between the agents and the company, in terms of the directive, the policy manual itself is clear. Default 50-50 without any making any value judgment as to what any of the sales agents contributed, or if they tell it otherwise, based on how they tell it. And that's it. And in this instance, with respect to the 17 transactions on which M&M's claims are predicated.
Counsel, I understand what your position is, but you need to tell us what's wrong with the jury verdict. And this case actually went to a jury. So
sure.
Are you arguing that the evidence was insufficient as a matter of law for purposes of Rule 50? Are you arguing that there was some concrete error committed in the jury instructions? It's not enough just to restate the position you argued to the jury.
I understand. And as a matter of law, it was an error to submit the issue of fraud and the breach of contract claims and the tortious interference claims and the conversion claims to the jury under Rule 50, because in this instance either there was no contract.
Look, you can't mean, I think my client wins, therefore no rational person could think otherwise. Right? You must have some concrete reason why you think no rational person could disagree with you, even given that 12 jurors and a district judge did disagree with you. Are they? You need to tell us why you think those 13 people are all irrational, not just wrong.
And the reason why that they are irrational, say, is that they were distracted. They were misled because there is a contract or a document, you know, that what M&M has called the contract, that is clear that either there is a 50-50 split, or Marcus and Millichap, will write the agents checks based on what you tell us. And instead and that should have been dispositive. However, the case wasn't predicated, wasn't tried on what the terms of the agreement provided, what the so-called Constitution, the policy manual said. It was tried as though it were a fraud claim between Mr. Sekulowski and Mr. Luttner. In effect, the case was presented in a way that caused the jury, that caused the trial judge to focus on the relationship between Mr. Luttner and Mr. Sekulowski as opposed to the direct relationship between the sales agents and the company itself. And so as a consequence, and if you look at the court's reasoning in denying the post-trial motion, he's clear. He says, you know, there was evidence that showed that the amount of work that was reported, or that the commission splits did not coincide with the work contributed by each of the agents on the 17. That's why a jury could believe, as it did, rationally that there was a fraud, that there was a breach of contract. But that was the wrong question. That was the wrong issue because it had been misdirected. Had the focus been where it should have been on the policy manual that was identified as the directive as to how the operations were to be governed, that's what M&M said, then all that needed to be reported was simply, this is what our split is going to be, or that there'll be a presumptive 50-50 split. And again, the document itself highlights the defect in the reasoning that the amount of work contributed actually mattered in terms of how and the justification required by M&M for a split deviating from 50-50. The reason is that if you have a 50-50 split, by default, that assumes that you don't have to evaluate what the contribution would be of each of the sales agents. So as a matter of law, no rational jury could and should have even had an opportunity to consider the issue because the issue should have been decided as a matter of law before it reached the jury because the contract itself was clear, if indeed there's a contract, that the split would either be the default 50-50 or, as the agents reported, regardless of whether there would be any side agreement at all. In fact, the policy manual is silent as to any basis, any reasons, any rationale for splitting and how splitting could be. For example, I don't know why the agents couldn't have played poker the night before and split otherwise. I mean, that's the policy manual says nothing about what the contribution would be. Then you've got the issue of damages. Assuming that the plaintiff could clear the hurdle of the contract, the document that set out the relationship, which it shouldn't. The court provided the wrong measure of damages. The law is clear in Illinois that damages are measured by the effectively the benefit of the bargain, not what the defendant would get, but what the plaintiff would have gotten but for the fraud. So that, too, was an error that would require a new trial. But again, the focus is really this agreement, this so-called, this policy manual that sets the relationship between the parties was clear such that there the issue shouldn't have reached the jury because there was no dispute that Mr. Luttner and Mr. Sekulowski reported to the jury reported to M&M what the split was to be, and that was in fact the split that was given to them and the split that was ultimately realized by each of the men.
You're into your rebuttal time, you know.
I'll reserve the rest.
Mr. Alexander.
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor is interested in jurisdiction. May I address that with the court?
Yes, please.
My answer is twofold. First of all, in both the pretrial order and in Mr. Sekulowski's answer to our complaint and in his own second amended counterclaim, he concedes Ohio jurisdiction, therefore mooting the issue of further evidence on that.
Sorry. People can't stipulate to jurisdiction in federal court.
Well, no, they can't, Your Honor, and jurisdiction is something that any court can address. But if Mr. Sekulowski accedes to the issue, it removes the need for further proof. But in addition, Your Honor, there is proof of this issue in the trial itself. First of all, it's undisputed from the record that Mr. Sekulowski was not an Illinois resident. Therefore, there is no question of diversity jurisdiction.
Both you and Mr. Goodman seem to have trouble with residence. Jurisdiction does not depend on residence. It depends on domicile.
And may I address that? Mr. Sekulowski's testimony.
I'd appreciate it if you'd address the correct issue. Yes.
Mr. Sekulowski's testimony at trial was that he had a home in Illinois, that he resided with his family in Illinois, and that other than a little bit of work that he did in Arizona, he spent all of his time in Ohio, excuse me, I think I said Illinois, that he had had a home in Ohio, that he had his family was in Ohio, that he had moved to Ohio prior to the beginning of the trial and after his termination from Mark Similshep and after he'd gone to Arizona. Therefore, the evidence presented to the jury at trial was that Mr. Sekulowski's family was in Ohio, that his home was in Ohio, and that he resided in Ohio with his family.
Mm-hmm.
That, in addition to the joint pretrial order and Mr. Sekulowski's own pleadings to the court, I think more than established diversity jurisdiction. Now, if I could address the issue that I think troubles the court or is before the court, and that is Mr. Sekulowski's failure to attack dead on the judgment that is at issue, because if the court accepts the evidence as to breach of contract, none of the other issues before this panel need be addressed. Mr. Sekulowski has not challenged the fact that there was a contract. In fact, Mr. Sekulowski sued for breach of contract, and at page 23 of his brief and in his second amended counterclaim states that there was a contract. The only question is, what were the terms? Mr. Sekulowski doesn't take issue with the jury charge. In fact, Mr. Sekulowski charged the jury the exact same way that the court charged the jury with respect to Mark Similshep's breach of contract questions.
What do you mean that Sekulowski charged the jury? Only judges charge juries.
I apologize.
You his proposed jury instructions that the judge used?
Yes, Your Honor. His proposed instructions were identical to Mark Similshep's. In addition, obviously, he did not take issue with the court's proposed instructions on contract, on implied contract, and on measure of damages. Mr. Sekulowski does not appeal to this court the measure of damages for the contract questions or the award of damages, or the amount of damages. His entire issue with regard to fraud damages is moot unless the panel concludes that there's not enough evidence to support the breach of contract findings. And there is enough evidence on that issue in spades. First of all, as I said, it's undisputed that there was a contract. The only question is, what were the terms? The contract could have been oral or it could have been implied. And there was sufficient evidence as to both in the record. It's undisputed that Mr. Sekulowski was bound by the policy manual when he was in Ohio. It's also undisputed by Mr. Sekulowski's own testimony that when he came to Chicago, his agreement with Mark Similshep was unchanged as to both payments, the issue of commission splits, which goes to how much he's going to get out of a particular deal and how that increases with his increased commissions over the course of the year, with regard to his obligations to pay into the legal fund. All these issues are addressed in the record, and they're at pages 546 and 47 of Mr. Sekulowski's testimony in the trial court record. Therefore, there was more than enough evidence for the jury to conclude that there was an agreement. Mr. Sekulowski testified to the agreement. There was more than enough evidence to conclude that the agreement followed the policy manual in connection with how all commissions were to be distributed and in connection with how he was obligated to pay into the legal fund. Mr. Sekulowski agreed to all those issues. The undisputed evidence from everyone else in the court that testified that either it was at the time or had before been affiliated with Mark Similshep was that everyone was bound by the terms of the policy manual. Mr. Hadigan testified to that. Mr. Luttner testified to that. Mr. Karen testified to that. And Mr. Lee testified to that. And I've got record sites for all that if the court's interested. It's undisputed that Mr. Sekulowski paid into the legal fund as required. That goes to the issue of consideration. It also goes to the issue of his continuing obligation and continuing agreement to be bound by the terms of the policy manual, irrespective of whether he was located in Ohio or located in Illinois. Therefore, the issue of whether the jury had sufficient evidence on which to base a verdict for breach of oral contract or the existence and breach of an implied contract is overwhelming. Mr. Sekulowski also takes issue with the evidence of his failure to put on certain evidence with regard to Mr. Luttner. Again, the question is, did the court abuse its discretion in excluding certain evidence with regard to Mr. Luttner. And the evidence on that is, additionally, I would submit, overwhelming. One of the issues Mr. Sekulowski takes issue with is the failure to grant a new trial in connection with a post-trial email that he alleges was sent by Mr. Luttner. That email was disputed, and we have evidence in the record from Mr. Luttner that he never wrote it and never sent it. The court obviously didn't abuse its discretion in not granting a new trial in connection with an email whose authenticity was disputed and which was clearly hearsay. The same issue goes with respect to the rest of the evidence. Mr. Sekulowski wants to pitch this as a he-said-she-said contest in which Mark Similishap put all its eggs and was required to put all its eggs in Mr. Luttner's basket. And that's simply not the case. In fact, every issue, every element, everything we needed to prove, we did prove outside of Mr. Luttner's testimony. And I can cite the court in that regard to the testimony of Mr. Vogel at pages 312 to 315, in which he testified that he overheard at a lunch Mr. Luttner and Mr. Sekulowski discussing the very deal that was the heart of the fraud and the heart of the bulk of the breach of contract damages. I would also cite the panel to Mr. Sekulowski's own emails, Exhibits 15 and 20, in which he responds to communications from Mr. Luttner agreeing that this plan to steal almost $670,000 from my client was in place. We did not need and we did not rely on Mr. Luttner's testimony with regard to any issue or any aspect of the proof of this case. Nor did we hitch our wagon to Mr. Luttner's star. In fact, I would cite the court to our own closing argument at page 1156, in which we told the jury exactly what we thought of Mr. Luttner and exactly what we thought of his co-conspiracy with Mr. Sekulowski. With regard to the exclusion of evidence, the court engaged in a very rational balancing test on all these issues. First of all, the two exhibits Mr. Sekulowski mainly takes issue with are exhibits 117 and 118. Well, with regard to 118, Mr. Sekulowski agreed to the redaction that he now complains of, and that's at page 878 in the record. But even if he hadn't, the court's decision to exclude a few limited snippets of hearsay within those documents was more than understandable, and didn't take away from the significant impeachment evidence that was allowed in regarding Mr. Luttner. Mr. Luttner was no saint, and there was plenty of evidence to that put forth by both sides, frankly. Mr. Luttner was, number one, a co-conspirator in the deal. Mr. Luttner, the evidence was, threatened to kill Mr. Sekulowski. That came in. Mr. Luttner had a pending suit against Sekulowski, establishing his bias. That came into evidence. Mr. Luttner's alleged forgery came into evidence through Mr. Sekulowski's testimony. Mr. Luttner sent drunk emails to Mr. Sekulowski that were threatening in nature. He was fired for being a rogue agent and being a terrible guy. And that was introduced into the record through one of our own witnesses. So there really was no abuse of discretion with regard to any of those issues. And again, unless the panel concludes there was insufficient evidence on the breach of contract issue, either oral or implied, there is no need to reach any of the other issues addressed in appellant's brief. Unless the panel has any other questions, I think it's clear the panel has got this, and I appreciate the court's time.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything further, Mr. Goodman?
Just a couple of points, Your Honor. The phrase co-conspirator was used liberally, and we talk about what the contract is and the oral contract, and they point, again, back to the policy manual. There is no conspiracy. Whether there's a side deal, a side agreement, is immaterial. Whether there's a side deal between Mr. Luttner and Mr. Sekulowski is immaterial to the claims by M&M against Mr. Sekulowski, because, again, M&M's position was that the policy manual in terms of the commission and how commissions are to be split defines what that relationship is, how that's to be done. The other point I think that is important to address is essentially the no harm, no foul with respect to the exclusion about evidence of the emails from Mr. Luttner, because there was other evidence that Mr. Luttner was a rogue. The point that didn't come out because of the exclusion of the evidence, though, is that Mr. Luttner testified that M&M had paid for his lawsuit against, or had promised to pay for his lawsuit against Mr. Sekulovsky. Again, whether that was true or not, it certainly goes to the bias, and was evidence that the jury did not get to hear. So they may have heard that Mr. Luttner did not like Mr. Sekulovsky, and there was tension between them, but it did not get to hear that M&M was involved in exploiting that, at least according to Mr. Luttner. Nothing further.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.